Support for this KQED podcast comes from Bay Meadows, an urban village in San Mateo. Fitness and movies in the park, Caltrain, artisan eateries, fun for the kids, all just a hop from your front door. Homes now selling and leasing, baymeadows.com.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, management expert Jeffrey Pfeffer says the leadership industry has failed. He believes that too many businesses collapse and too many employees disengage because of bad leaders and misguided advice. He makes the case for reforming leadership evaluation and leadership training in his new book, Leadership BS, Fixing Workplaces and Careers, One Truth at a Time. We'll be joined by him in the hour ahead. That's next. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Jeffrey Pfeffer, who is a professor in Stanford's Graduate School of Business and the author of 14 books or co-author of 14 books, as well as a world management expert and an expert on power and leadership, is joining us for this Forum hour. His newest book is called Leadership BS, and it's all about failure of leadership and also about unhappiness in the workplace. And those are phenomena that are not unrelated. He's been a visiting professor at both London and Harvard business schools, as well as Singapore Management University, and we welcome him back to the Forum program. Good to have you here again.
It's nice to be back with you.
Well, let's begin by the last time you were on, we talked about power a lot. You wrote a book called Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. And I suppose you could say the same about leadership. What you learned from your book and a lot of empirical data to back this is there are a lot of people who are leaders, at least in name or in position, but probably shouldn't be.
That's exactly right. But one of the great interesting contradictions in life is that we think we know what we want in leaders, modesty, authenticity, people who will take care of other people. But then you look at who gets ahead and the qualities that make people successful, even in the political realm, such as Donald Trump and Carly Fiorina currently, are not these qualities. These are not modest people. They're not people who necessarily take care of others, and they're certainly not people who always tell the truth. So we have this wonderful disjuncture between what we say we want and what we actually select for.
Or what we seek and select. I mean, the fact of the matter is, as you point out in your book, we're not getting what we think we want, and in many instances, we're getting what perhaps we think or realize we need.
That could be. I think many of the qualities that we don't think we want are actually quite useful. I'm not sure that anybody, even though we say, for instance, we want people to tell the truth all the time, most people and most of your listeners would say that the correct answer when your partner says, "Does this outfit make me look fat?" The correct answer is no. Do you love me as much as you did when I met you, 25 years ago? The correct answer is yes. A lot of social relationships depend upon people being responsive to what the party in the interaction really wants and needs, not necessarily some principles that we ought to act by.
One could get a bit cynical just foraging through some of this material that we're talking about here. I mean, success seems to be, at least in leadership, often aligned with self-aggrandizement, lying, a bogus self-presentation, narcissism. And in many instances, as you point out in your book, these are people who are not necessarily even educated for the roles that they're playing. In fact, many and perhaps even most are not.
That's exactly right. So the subtitle of this book is, I think, almost as important as the title, which of course is Leadership BS. The subtitle is Fixing Workplaces and Careers, One Truth at a Time. And so given the observation you just made, which is we're not getting the people that we want and need, or we're certainly getting people with some interesting qualities and characteristics, including narcissism and self-aggrandizement, if we are to change what is going on, if we are to change a world that really hasn't changed for the better in 60 or 70 years, at least with respect to leadership in terms of the data, which we may or may not go on to talk about. We need to understand why this is going on. And in many instances, I think the companies and their own personnel practices are complicit in this process. So, you know, if we didn't want to choose narcissists, there is a very well-developed scale called the Narcissist Personality Inventory, which you could give not to the individuals, but to even people who observe the individuals, and you could then deselect for narcissists.
Although that scale has come under some attack, too, as I'm sure you're aware. But, you know, we need some kind of metric here. We need some kind of touchstone to measure what kind of job is being done in terms of the ideals, because it's not serving the ideals that people have about leadership at all. You read your book, and the data's all there, and it's all pretty convincing. And it also convinces us maybe that Leo Durocher was right, at least about leaders. Nice guys finish last in too many instances. In fact, you also quote, I guess it's Bill Sentry of the Center for Creative Leadership, who says about 50% of leaders are failures in the roles that they're assuming.
That is correct. And so part of what your question, I think, points to is this issue of how do you define or what do you mean when you say successful leader? And so you know, one of the examples in the book is Stan O'Neill of Merrill Lynch. And Stan O'Neill, of course, was CEO of Merrill Lynch, took Merrill Lynch into bad straits during the 2007-2008 financial crisis. Merrill was then bought by the Bank of America in a kind of a distressed fire sale. Many Merrill Lynch employees were laid off. Stan O'Neill left with $140 million. So if you're Mr. and Mrs. O'Neill, Stan O'Neill was quite successful. If you're one of the Merrill Lynch employees who was laid off, you're not so successful. By that criteria, he wasn't such a successful leader. So I think one of the big issues that we have to grapple with is the fact that success for the individual and success for the group are not always the same thing.
We had a discussion, in fact, we had another Stanford business profile, Mark Leslie. We were talking about CEO compensation, and how much does that play into this? I mean, workers look at these kind of not only packages like you mentioned with respect to Stan O'Neill, but the kind of money that CEOs are paid compared to the rank and file.
Well, I think CEO compensation is a piece of the problem. But I think for the workers and for the rank-and-file employees, what I think matters to them and what goes on in their work environment. And there you've got lots of data from Gallup and all the human resource consulting firms that show relatively low levels of employee engagement, relatively low levels of trust in leaders, declining pretty consistently job satisfaction, leaders losing their jobs at higher rates, not only CEOs, but lower level leaders as well, distrust. One of my favorite statistics, which I found and included in the book, is Parade Magazine did a survey in 2012 and said to people, you know, would you rather have a substantial pay raise or be able to fire your boss? And 35% of the people said they would prefer to fire their boss. So I think for the people in the workplace, I think the CEO pay is a piece of it, but it's mostly what has been happening to them in their work environments where they are working more hours. Their pay is in many instances stagnated, and they're not getting led by people that they respect or trust or like, because those people are for the most part looking out for themselves.
And in many instances, their contractors or their job insecurity in general, the transactional nature of it has changed so much. And I can't help thinking about the first segment we did this morning about the possibility of Kevin McCarthy becoming the next Speaker of the House. And a lot of that has to do with his personal relations. I mean, he really, whatever one wants to say for or against the guy, he goes to great lengths to really be amicable, take a personal interest in the people in the House that he's going to have to work with if he becomes a speaker and everything. That makes a big difference. You know, if a leader has an open door, if a leader seems to care and really be responsibly reflective of those kinds of cares and concerns, it certainly makes people more engaged, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. Though, of course, it's very important to distinguish between really caring and, of course, acting as if you care.
You know the old Hollywood line, you make it in Hollywood and you can fake sincerity. Yeah.
That's exactly correct.
But let's go back to leadership itself, because it's become a whole industry, and you write about this. There are all these leadership education books and blogs and posts and TED Talks and so forth. And this is a failure of leadership in terms of what it's designed to do to a great extent. I think you point out that, you know, jobs are still being lost at high rates. And the fact of the matter is that leadership in the way that people are teaching it, they almost are pedagogical about it, or the kind of suits who come in and say, this is what you need to do and so forth, without knowing the culture of the place or anything at all. It's ludicrous.
It is. The leadership industry is enormous. McKinsey estimates it at $14 billion a year. Barbara Kellerman, who's a lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School, estimates it $50 billion a year just in the U.S. My estimate, extrapolated from the American Society for Training and Development, is $20 billion a year. So this is an enormous industry. It clearly, based upon the data on employee engagement, trust in leaders, and all the other things we've been talking about, has not improved over the last 60 or 70 years. So I think we need to do things differently if we're going to if we're going to make substantial improvements, which goes to, I think, this again, the subtitle. We need to fix workplaces and careers, and we need to do it by focusing on the empirical realities. And so you've made a reference to the suits who come in. One of the interesting things is that, this is an industry beset with stories. So you read these books, the autobiographies, or you all these the many CEOs and other people stand up and tell stories. And one of the things that
get a ghostwriter who makes them into a myth.
That's exactly correct.
I'm afraid, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I mean we're really pretty much on the same wavelength here. And too much leadership, as you point out in your book, is just illusory. It's sugar-coated. And to a great extent, you can say that leadership, as far as industry is concerned, has failed.
The leadership industry has clearly failed because it hasn't made workplaces better. It hasn't helped leaders in their careers. That is absolutely correct. And part of the issue is exactly the sugarcoating. So if, you know, as I tell people, because my favorite chapter of this book happens to be chapter 4, which is on lying, but and which I actually on some days will tell you is the most important characteristic of a successful leader, the better ability to lie successfully. And people say, no, we ought to be building a culture of truth-telling. And if that's true, then you need to understand why lying is as prevalent as it is and why it doesn't get sanctions. Because if we're going to change, we have to face the empirical realities. I mean, you would not have in medicine people saying, well, you need to wash your hands, which of course you do, to have good hygienic practices. And you would not just say that. You would actually go out and measure how much hand washing there was. And when you saw insufficient attention to hygiene, you would figure out why and design interventions and measure those interventions. And none of this has really gone on with leadership.
We're talking with Jeffrey Pfeffer. His new book is Leadership BS, Fixing Workplaces and Careers, One Truth at a Time. And we'll certainly get you, our listeners, involved in this discussion and maybe hear some stories from you, stories maybe we hope about good leadership, but also no doubt about bad leadership. And there are a lot of toxic workplaces, as you point out in your book, Jeffrey, and the real challenge is what to do about it, what to remedy it. At one point, I think it was an article you did, you've been doing a lot. You're also kind of a great self-leader in terms of promoting your own work, because I noticed a lot of articles that I've read that and you just mentioned chapter 4, I think, is the best chapter. It's good to decide what's the best chapter in your book. It's very hard. Sometimes like deciding, you know, your favorite child almost. But you're making us mindful at one point, I think it may be in that Fortune article, of the possibility of electing leaders.
Yes, and the election thing, I think, is exactly the same. You look at I guess he's still number one in the Republican polls, Donald Trump. And if you look again at the leadership literature, what are you supposed to do? You're number with Jim Collins, who I'm sure you know well and all your listeners would know, has this fabulous book, Good to Great, in which he talks about level five leaders. And the first quality of a level five leader is modesty, which Donald Trump is certainly not. His name is on everything. Number two, we talk again, we go back to the subject of telling the truth. Donald Trump is not constrained at all by any kind of empirical realities. He will tell you that his book, The Art of the Deal, is the number one best-selling business book of all time, even though it isn't. And, you know, he'll say whatever.
He'll say he's never been bankrupt.
Yes, he'll say he's never been bankrupt. He'll say that Mexico is sending their worst people here, for which is empirical evidence. He will talk about how all these immigrants are causing crime. There's no evidence for that either. And what's interesting to me is not that he says that, but that it doesn't matter. That the fact that you can, you know, exaggerate and engage in these behaviors, in fact, has to some extent made him more popular.
Well, you also write about Carly Fiorina and say she's very good at self-promotion, which I agree,
yes,
at telling her story, at building a brand, all of that. And so, you know, suddenly her stock has shot up enormously. Plus, people feel they don't want politicians, and that's helped her the same way it's helped Trump. But the sense is that as a leader at HP, in fact, it was Trump who said, you know, you were a lousy leader and pretty much tried to sink her ship by talking about her lack of leadership at HP and all the people that were laid off and so forth. It's almost as if these things become obscured by self-presentation to a great degree. I mean, I don't mean to make it seem like it's a Barnum and Bailey world where, you know, they're all suckers out there, or citizens are not enlightened, because I have a great deal of faith in the body politic, more perhaps than I should. But aren't we talking about that? People who are able to—I mean, yes. Trump is more a salesman than anything else, so is Carly Fiorina.
That's exactly correct. I have a friend who teaches at Berkeley, and when I did the column, I talked to him, and he said that Carly Fiorina had come to Berkeley when she was CEO of HP to give a talk. And he went home to his wife that night and said, I'm not sure she's a good CEO, but she's going to be a fabulous politician. So I think that that is certainly correct.
Also, I was talking about some articles you wrote. Can you talk about where you connect Pope Francis with Starbucks?
Oh, yes.
I mean, this is also a question of leadership.
Yes. Well, the connection between Pope Francis and Starbucks, Pope Francis's visit, I think, was wonderful. And he had wonderful messages, which were forgotten even almost before the words were out of his mouth. But Pope Francis, one of his messages and one of the messages of the Catholic Church has been to take care of the least advantaged and to really watch out for the welfare of human beings, you know, the poor and the downtrodden and everybody, that we have a moral responsibility to take care of people. And Starbucks has put out, and Starbucks, by the way, is certainly not the worst of the companies in this category. As a retail company, they offer relatively generous benefits. But there was this whole thing that they were going to give people advance notice on what their schedules will be so they could arrange for childcare and do other things and manage their lives and fill in with other work if they weren't going to get enough hours. And Starbucks now has apparently not implemented that very well. And so I think this illustrates a very important point that many companies say people are our most important asset. Many companies in their annual reports thank their employees for doing all such wonderful things. But when it comes time to implementing the policies, and particularly at any moment when there is any kind of economic stringency, companies often break their commitments. And so I think the Pope reminds us that if we make a commitment to take care of people, we should actually honor that commitment.
But of course, what you hear from leaders over and over again, as far as taking care of their employees or making sure that their employees are well cared for, bottom line, I have a board of directors to answer to.
Well, as the Gallup organization and Tom Rath and Jim Harder have pointed out, and there's a lot of evidence for this from other organizations as well, there is really no conflict, because companies with high levels of employee well-being, according to the Gallup data, also are companies that have lower turnover, so they reduce those costs and perform better and have higher levels of employee engagement.
We're talking again with Jeffrey Pfeffer. His new book is Leadership BS, Fixing Workplaces and Careers, One Truth at a Time. If so many people are alienated now and not socially engaged in their work, maybe was Karl Marx right?
I don't know if Karl Marx was right, but there are certainly, this is an economy which, as you know, is not working for every human being, it's working for the people at the top. But there is a lot, you used the phrase earlier, there is a lot of economic insecurity. And there is certainly people working more and more hours. And the next book on which I'm working on, unfortunately, it's not done yet, has a working title called Dying for a Paycheck, which talks about the health effects of economic insecurity and the health effects of these long work hours and the health effects of actually many different dimensions of the work environment. Two colleagues and I, doctoral students now at Harvard and Stefano Zinios, and I did a series of studies, one of which shows that 120,000 excess deaths a year in the United States from the work environment.
So what can we do not only to make that work environment better? I may be getting a jump on your new book here, but also what can we do about leadership? I mean, if leadership is across the board not providing the trust or not living up to the standards and ideals that people have about leadership, let's talk about fixing it.
Okay. So I have a number of suggestions. I'll cover a few of them and then we can see if you want to hear about even more. So the first suggestion I would make is you need to look at your leadership development activities, the speeches, the books, the seminars, and everything else. And instead of doing evaluation as it's currently done, which is either not at all, or they give people these happy sheets, the, you know, did you have a good time? Did you like the speaker? Were you inspired? So essentially, you're evaluating the speakers and the books and everything on their entertainment value, which is not quite good. So if you want to improve employee engagement, if you want to improve trust in leaders, if you want to improve leader tenure, those are the criteria by which you ought to evaluate your leadership development activity. So the first thing you need to do is fix evaluation. It's the simplest message that comes from the quality movement and goes back like a long time. The next thing you ought to do is you ought to hire people to do the leadership development activities who have relevant credentials. So I took a look at some Inc. list of the best leadership experts, and of the top 20, after which I got too depressed to go through the rest of the top 50, but of the top 20, five have advanced degrees in a relevant field. One has no degree at all. Two have doctorates in theology. Theology is a great field, but it's not clear that would, you know, prepare you to be effective in teaching or developing leaders, but it might. And if you go to the top 20 people, all of their websites say, what is their expertise? Their expertise is talking. So we have built an industry in which, you know, there's no credentials to be in the industry. You can be a leadership coach without any credentials. You can be a leadership expert without particularly any credentials. You would certainly not have surgery from somebody with this absence of credentials. We evaluated incorrectly by the entertainment value rather than by whether or not it fixes things. So you have, and the questions you're asking me, Michael, you have implicit in each of those questions is an idea that we ought to be making things better. And that's exactly right. And therefore, you ought to evaluate the activities as to whether or not we're making progress.
And I should obviously be leaving. I've been talking for all these years. I should be leading a Fortune 500 company or something like that.
You should be. But what about, it would probably be better.
But what about the myth of leaders? I mean, what they should be versus what we seem to really want from them. And that includes political leaders. I mean, this is embedded in the culture, as I think your book makes clear. So what do we do about transforming that or really diminishing the myth versus the reality? What can be done?
I'm not 100% sure as to how we could diminish the myth versus the reality. I think the first thing we need to do is we need to do due diligence on leaders. So it's interesting. I sometimes tell people when I'm giving talks on this, if I told you I had invented the cure for cancer and I would sell it to you for $500 million, would you write me a check for $500 million? And the answer, of course, is no. Even though, by the way, $500 million, had I invented the cure for cancer, would be a bargain price. You would first do what you do when you make any other investment. You would do due diligence. You would say, are the stories, are your claims based in reality? I see people come to Stanford Business School, to the View from the Top series. I see people doing books. I see people who have actually, as you know, from reading this book, some of your guests on this show, you know, and they put out these stories. And it turns out the more improbable the story, the more heroic the story, and therefore the less likely it is to be true, the more we want to believe it. And so we don't do due diligence. So the first thing we need to do if we want to learn what good leaders do and what bad leaders do, you need to start, I think, from the facts. And so when some leader stands up and says, you know, I've accomplished this, my employees love me, blah-de-blah, the first thing you ought to do is go to Glassdoor, go to the public record, see how many times he's been sued or she, ask how many wives and husbands they've had. I mean, you know, do a little diligence. And then we can get down again. And I understand that this is, you know, this doesn't make people feel good, but the only way we're going to build a better leadership enterprise is with the is paying attention to the facts.
Well, our guest is Jeffrey Pfeffer. His book is Leadership BS, and we welcome your involvement in the program. What do you want in leaders? What do you expect? Hope some leader stories or lack of leadership stories. Join us. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Management expert Jeffrey Pfeffer says the leadership industry has failed, and he believes that too many businesses collapse and too many employees disengage because of bad leaders and misguided advice. And he makes the case for reforming leadership evaluation and training in his new book, Leadership BS. Fixing Workplaces and Careers, One Truth at a Time. He's professor of organizational behavior with the Graduate School of Business at Stanford. And you may want to join this conversation. If you do, let me give out the toll-free number again. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. And you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Let me go to our callers, and we begin with you, Alexander. Good morning.
Good morning. Just a couple of comments. First of all, I think there's a lot of successful folks out there who try to tell you how to do it, and we've seen plenty of folks do that. And unfortunately, some of these successful folks turn into role models, and a lot of professors try to perpetuate these myths. And I think a lot of credit goes to Jeff for taking this heads on. I know it hasn't always been easy for him, since it's occasionally gotten him in hot water. But I think to students of his like me, I just think it's been great that he's brought a lot of clarity and helped shine the light on who are the right role models and what we should strive for as we improve ourselves. So kudos to him and kudos to for him writing this book.
Okay, thank you, former student. Wow. Obviously, you recognize the voice?
No, I don't. But thank you. And I, you know, what I tell people is that I'm old, which gives you a certain amount of kind of freedom, and I'm tenured, which gives you a certain amount of freedom. And so I'm old, both old and tenured. So I'm pretty much, I believe my job as a social scientist is to tell the truth, and not everybody wants to hear the truth. And you got my favorite scene, as you know, is the scene in A Few Good Men when Jack Nicholson and Tom Cruise, you can't handle the truth. I think people need the truth.
Here's Ann. Ann, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment because what the presenter really resonated. I was a senior manager in a large organization of 55,000 people and attended many board-level presentations. And I could almost see the cultural impact of people standing up and making PowerPoints that exaggerated points and misrepresented facts. About 70% of the people in the audience obviously didn't know what was going on, but the 30% who really knew that these programs were not doing what was being said, that really began to tell them it's okay culturally to make those exaggerations. And the result is kind of corrosive because people begin to think it's okay, and then they turn around and do it. And then you make really bad decisions, because top people don't have the right information. And they weren't outright lies, but it was sort of the Carly Fiorina that I grew the revenue at HP. And it's not really truth-telling, and it's wrong, plus corrosive, plus you make really bad decisions.
Okay, Anne, we thank you. And I suppose that ties in pretty much with your vision of things, Jeff Pfeffer?
That is exactly correct. And, you know, so I think, you know, the social science research suggests that exaggeration or prevarication is pervasive. And one of my favorite stories out of my favorite chapter is from David Kaplan's book, The Silicon Boys, which talks about Larry Ellison. And, you know, the software industry has this phrase associated with it, vaporware. And the idea of vaporware is that you sell product that is not quite yet developed and has features that you claim for features which it doesn't have. And Ed Oakes, one of the co-founders of Oracle, is being interviewed by David, and they said, does Larry Ellison lie? And Ed Oakes' response is, we prefer to say Larry has problem with tenses, as in the product is available, is now that you've asked me about it, I will go and develop it. So, I mean, there are industries, and the software industry for a long time was based upon this idea of you would say, yes, I have this product for you, and it has these features, but of course it didn't, and that's where the phrase vaporware comes from.
We did a whole program on startups and the way that the truth would be embellished or attenuated or in some ways simply not conveyed because with venture capital, of course, one needs to perhaps present. And, you know, I've seen studies that show that most resumes are padded and inflated. I mean, this is a ubiquitous problem in many
ways. That's right. And online dating. I think the online dating profiles, 85% are inaccurate.
You know, people who've tried online dating and, you know, you get all these horror stories about, I thought I was meeting someone about 25 years younger. This is the yes. photograph that they put on there, whatever. Let me get another caller on here. Bob, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I was wondering if there's any industries where, you know, lack of leadership or there is you see greater problems as far as leadership. The reason I ask is I'm currently a nurse. It's a second career for me. I have a business background, and I love working with nurses. I have some of the best colleagues that I work alongside. But I've noticed that a lot of times, you know, being a good nurse and putting in time at the bedside and having that the seniority often leads to a leadership position, and I don't think they don't necessarily get the leadership training they need. And I was just wondering if there's any industries that stand out as far as kind of lacking leadership.
I think the problems I'm describing are, I think there's enormous variation across individual companies, but I don't see very much variation across industries, because you can find great leaders in essentially every industry, and you can find the kind of bad leaders in every industry, just you can find good and bad politicians. So I don't see a big industry difference here.
Thanks for the question, Bob. Good to hear from you. We'll hear from another listener from Lafayette. Lauren, join us. You're on the air.
Thank you. So my name is Lauren, and I work for a local Oakland-based pet food store that I think gets leadership right. I've been able to grow with the company in a leadership position, and one of the things that they really emphasize is constantly evaluating your motivation for the leadership decisions that you're making. And the speaker talked about evaluating, you know, truth in the stories that leaders are telling. But I'm wondering how, as people move up the chain, you can continue to have people evaluate their own motivations and if they're really making decisions that are right for the people they're leading.
Well, I think one answer is what Hewlett-Packard used to do, but they've stopped doing it long ago, which is you ask. There was a time when even at HP, they would give employees surveys and about their leaders and about whether or not they were behaving in ways that were supportive and caused the employees to be engaged with the leader. And there's an old saying that Gallup and other organizations have said that nobody leaves a job, you leave a leader, which is, I think, right, if you leave a boss. And so HP used to make that part of their promotion policies, and they used to make it part of their performance evaluation system. And so the simplest thing to do is to ask other people, you know, is this leader effective, and is this individual causing me to do my best work? Or to use another phrase, at the end of the day, when I go home from work, do I feel better than when I came in? Do I feel like I've had a good and productive day? But under the pressures of layoffs and the bottom line and other kinds of things, that kind of HP culture has disappeared.
Let me thank the caller and go to some of your emails. Anne writes, do bosses in toxic workplaces have any idea how bad their leadership is? I've worked for several bosses who created secretive, punishing, fear-based environments, but all three frequently would mention their skills at leadership. What's that about? Who's giving them the message that they're good at leading, not their direct subordinates? Actually, a thought occurs to me that sometimes sycophantic employees can make them feel that they're really good leaders, but also it makes me think of Carly Fiorina again, because she was well known for not standing or really in any way putting up with any criticism or being defied in any way or being even challenged. She had quite a reputation along those lines that's been written about and spoken about. But a lot of these so-called leaders just don't get it. They don't have any idea, really, do they?
Well, I'm not sure if they don't have any idea, but it's very much like the VC. Not the VC, but the entrepreneurial example that you just came up with. I mean, people want to present themselves. First of all, people are motivated to think of themselves in a positive way, and people will also present stuff. So even if I know I'm failing, I'm not going to come out probably and say, you know, Michael, I'm failing. I don't know what I'm doing. I may present myself in a positive way. And there's some studies done by, including by Cameron Anderson at UC Berkeley, that suggest that even unwarranted self-confidence works.
Here's Heather, who writes, I like what Bob Sutton at Stanford says, that the difference between how people treat the powerful and powerless is as good a measure of character in leaders. As a career coach, I see distinctly how leaders of present take advantage of the nervously employed. Lots of workplace trauma out there. Another listener, Ben, comments, leadership takes vision, and vision is inherently egotistical because it usually comes from one person's imagination. So should a good leader be a visionary or something else?
Depends upon how you define a good leader, but certainly many good leaders are high in narcissism, and the point that's being made, I think, is exactly right. In order to do great things, you have to be willing to, kind of go your own way, trod your own path, and you can't worry an enormous amount about what everybody else is thinking. My good friend who comes to my class on power, Gary Loveman, who for many years run Harrah's and now Caesars, and now he stepped down to be non-executive chairman, he's told my class once, you want to be like, get a dog. A dog will like you unconditionally. The job of a leader is not necessarily to be popular. It is to do decisions that is to make decisions that are good for the company.
Here's a listener who says, it seems to me that the so-called leadership industry is largely about pandering to the greed and hubris of bad management and giving them ineffective solutions that maintain the status quo. Management never seems to learn that the problem with management is that it appeals to exactly the wrong type of person, to the do-nothing, to the greed head, to the person without talent. Such a person is always trying to keep labor under control and exploit it. Or am I wrong about that? Sounds a bit harsh, but
it is a little harsh. But there's an element in the comment that I think is exactly right, which is you get the leadership training and the leadership industry and the leadership books that the market demands. So if the market demands, you know, fictionalized, even though they're not called fiction, fictionalized works about people and stories that have almost no resemblance to reality and that are inspiring, we could spend some time talking about why inspiration is a poor way to accomplish organizational change, then that's what they'll get. So in that sense, I think we're getting what, we're getting what the customers are buying. Whether or not that's good for them is a whole other thing, and I think, of course, it isn't.
I'm going to go to more of your calls in a moment. I want to go to a couple of tweets here, though. A listener asks, why aren't we using the word management? Is that word gone out of favor for some reason?
Yes, that's for sure.
Another tweet from Pamela who says, I would love to hear the professor's thoughts on how his concepts apply to the evolving field of women's leadership development.
I think they apply equally because even though women have, of course, greater challenges in reaching leadership roles, many of the issues for the women leaders who are successful, Martha Stewart, at least, is successful in making a lot of money and reaching high levels. Martha Stewart, Carly Fiorina, Tina Brown in the media industry, they are very similar to the qualities that we're talking about, the large ego, the great amount of self-confidence, the willingness to look out mostly for their own interests.
There's a kind of myth, though, isn't there, that women are more social and more caring and more compassionate if they're in a leadership role than men would be? I mean, you're saying, in effect, they can be just as egotistical and just as false and et cetera, et cetera.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Let me get some more calls on here. We're going to go to Oakland next. Ron, you're on.
Hi, good morning, Michael. When your speaker was talking about the quality of leadership today, I was wondering if he was just talking about today and if you could make a contrast between Henry J. Ford as an industry leader and Henry J. Kaiser versus what you have today, I think, for the most part, I'm guessing, the Donald Trumps and the Fiorinas, who conflate being a politician with being a businessman. And really, the quality they enhance to be successful is the ability to fire people, the us against them mentality, keep those people out. Our company's number one. And really, the art of fantasy making. And I've been at my shop 29 years, and I've seen a lot of leadership come and go. And the other parallel I'm thinking of is the educational example. There's a lot of metrics to be had in the shop. And a lot of time what I see happening with upper management making lower management perform is lower management do what my niece does, which is when I ask her, why aren't you studying for the exam? She said, well, if I go to class and study, that will just make me learn. But I'm actually studying to the test. So a lot of times what's happening is they're performing to the test, trying to get the measurement aspect of it.
Okay. Jeffrey Pfeffer.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, criteria and how we measure things are very important. I'm not sure that I would put up Henry Ford, who was, after all, a supporter of Adolf Hitler and the well-known anti-Semite. The original Henry Ford is an example of a great old-style leadership. And I think in every era, we've had people who have, I think, really been or exhibited the qualities that somebody like Jim Collins would talk about in his book, Good to Great. And in every era, we've had, I think, the majority of people who don't. It's interesting, in Good to Great, he talks about the companies that made that transition and the number of level five leaders. And out of 1,400 companies, he found fewer than 20. So they are very rare, but to be treasured when they're found.
You know, we get to political leaders, too, in all this. We've certainly touched upon it. But the thought has often occurred to me that a lot of the success of Barack Obama had to do not so much with experience. He was a community organizer, but with being really a fine orator and impressing people with his presence and so forth, which is just what you're kind of sending out a warning signal against here. On the other hand, George W. Bush was kind of a marble mouth and didn't necessarily speak that well or sound that intelligent. And yet people gave a certain fealty to him in terms of his leadership role. So it can go either way, can't it?
It certainly can. And I think as we think about electing a business person into a political leadership role, we need to be very careful to understand that the two roles are very different. I mean, you know, so in to win an election, you have to appeal to a lot of people. To get promoted, you probably have to appeal to one person, your boss or some board of directors that's going to put you in that role. So that I think is a very important distinction. And the other important distinction is that CEOs, particularly in today's world, for the most part, pick their boards of directors, and they have enormous power. So, you know, Michael has already referred to the fact that when people disagreed with Carly Fiorina at Hewlett-Packard, they got eliminated from the company. If Carly were to become president and she was to have to deal with, you know, the Speaker of the House, whoever that's going to be, and the majority leader in the Senate, and they disagree with her, she can't get rid of them. So it requires, I think, a very different set of skills to be successful in politics. You can't be as imperialistic, I think, as many CEOs are.
Another caller, Julia. Yes. Good morning.
You just covered pretty much of what I was thinking, because I'm leaning toward Bernie Sanders, but I've heard him talk one-on-one with interviewers, and I've been impressed with his ideas. But I heard him debating with Michelle Bachmann, and he loses his cool, and he gets really upset. And it's not that he's not right. I mean, he's arguing what her point is, and he's correct from my point of view in why he's arguing. But as a world leader, it concerns me that he's going to be overreactive, and I'm wondering.
That's true about Trump too.
I
know you're not considering supporting him with your vote. People who do support him have said that he just overreacts. Yeah.
But the thing is, do you think that he should be mindful of it, or do you think Bernie Sanders should be mindful of what he's doing, like rolling his eyes? And I mean, it doesn't dignify him, and it doesn't dignify the office, compared to saying to oneself, well, it's subjective. There'll be 50% of the people that love that because he's doing it, and 50% who don't.
Well, you know, Julia, it hurt Gore a lot when he rolled his eyes in that first debate. That's very clear in my mind. And in terms of playing a leadership role, how useful is it to show that kind of anger or to be hot under the collar like she's talking about?
Well, I think sometimes you need to display anger, but I think you should never be angry. So one of the exercises I try to do in my Pass the Power class at Stanford is what I sometimes call the desensitization exercise, because when people get very emotionally engaged or very angry or very emotional, you can't even do very simple skills like add up columns of numbers with great accuracy. So we need to learn to manage our emotions and to react strategically and thoughtfully to the situations that present themselves and not get carried away. But this is extremely tough. As my wife will tell you, I'm still trying to master that after I don't know how many thousands of years.
When you find the formula, let me know. And thank you, Julia. Listener wants to know what you think about the leadership of Volkswagen and the autocratic style of the Porsche family and all that. Any thoughts to share?
Well, I actually met their former leader, not the current leader, at the World Economic Forum many years ago, where I accidentally earned his favor by asking by complimenting him on how attractive his daughter was, and he pointed out to that was his wife, which says something about his ego and what he was up to. Volkswagen is I don't know how the Volkswagen story is going to fall out or roll out, but I think the Volkswagen causes us, of course, to think about previous issues in the auto industry. Lee Iacocca, was, even though most people don't remember this or know this, Leo Iacocca was associated with the design of the exploding gas tank in the Pinto. He went on from that position to become the, not only CEO of Chrysler, but then to write this autobiography. And if you read the autobiography, you will not find a single mention of his role in the designing the exploding gas tank in Pinto, which is, I think, a very important message that when, you know, you cannot always trust what leaders are going to tell you. They're going to engage in presenting stories that they want you to believe. And also leaders, people like Iacocca have overcame that and went on to even greater success.
Well, and he was another one of these businessmen who thought he could move into the realm of politics at one time. Didn't make it, but certainly had ambitions. Yeah. Reading a Facebook comment from Bruce, who says, I've had leadership training more than once. The best lessons focused on getting to understand the strengths and weaknesses of my team, encouraging their contributions, and dealing with conflicts in a constructive and humble way. One class used the movie 12 O'Clock High as a teaching tool. It really does have some useful lessons embedded in it. On my own, I've watched shows about airline disasters. It's very sobering how many accidents happened because the captain didn't want to listen to his crew. No. Now the trend is for airlines to train their crews to speak up when they have a concern and not let the captain shut them up. And here's William, who writes, I work in a large healthcare organization where leadership seems to mean having impeccable manners, not ruffling feathers, not going against the grain, and generally being smooth. People who are disruptive are generally relegated to non-leadership roles. Unfortunately, many of us think disruptive is what is required. Seems like a catch-22. You won't even break into middle management if you're in the least bit disruptive. And you're promoted based on your ability to follow rather than to lead.
That's certainly true, and you're promoted oftentimes based upon your ability to present a good picture of yourself, to talk in a very convincing manner, to look like a leader. There's been a bunch of studies on the effects of physical attractiveness on and height on salary. So, yes, you need to look like a leader and act like a leader. Whether or not you are a leader is a whole other thing.
Getting some really interesting questions about leaders here. Susan, for example, says, would your guest please comment on whether or not the studies have included nonprofit leaders? And if so, are there differences in leadership in nonprofits versus profits? Seems there might be due to the mission-driven nature of nonprofits.
I'm not familiar with any of studies that have done that, but I think her intuition is completely correct.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Mostly because very few people go into nonprofits out of ego or to make a lot of money. And so, therefore, I suspect the motives are different. And when I see people in nonprofit leadership roles who have come out of the for-profit sector, it is mostly because they want to live and be in a different way.
Here's Sven from Los Angeles, who says, seems liberals and conservatives approach leadership differently. Can your guest comment on how this affects what a good leader is for a liberal versus a conservative person?
That's a question I've never thought of.
It's a good one.
It is a good question. I presume the assumption is that the conservative is more into kind of maybe the authoritarianism or more directive, and the liberal may be more.
Studies seem to bear that out. Yeah. Here's a tweet from Carl. It says, business leadership and business administration require different skills. MBA and law degrees are not the answers. And Doug from Morgan Hill says, we have a HR complaining about lack of employee loyalty, yet the employee handbook stresses at-will employment. Yep. Why have so many companies adopted the Jack Welch model that every job is a sports position? You can do great work, but if your manager finds someone considered incrementally better, you're gone tomorrow.
That's exactly right. I did a paper with a colleague of mine who's now at the University of Virginia, Peter Bellamy, on reciprocity. The norm of reciprocity is a universal human norm, but we find that if you put people in an organizational context or tell them they're working in an organization or they're making a decision in an organizational context, the norm of reciprocity gets much weaker. And partly that's because organizations are future-oriented rather than past-oriented. Organizations are more instrumental and calculative in their orientation. But the comment is exactly right. What's interesting to me is not that, but even though people have been told for 40 years that they're employed at will and that their company owes them nothing, they still look to their employer for job security. Your job security comes from you. Chapter 7 in this book talks about the fact that you need to take care of yourself. And that's exactly what that comment implies.
And the book, again, is Leadership BS, Fixing Workplaces and Careers One Truth at a Time. Another interesting question from Norris, who says, would employee-owned and administered enterprises be a step forward in terms of utilizing your ideas of leadership, productivity, and job satisfaction?
What a fabulous question. And it's a fabulous question because to the extent that leaders do have faults and failures, one of the, and which is almost going to be inevitable, one of the solutions is to build systems which are less leader-centric. And that could certainly be employee ownership or systems like partnerships in consulting firms or accounting firms or investment banking firms before they all went public, where the leaders were actually elected by the employees. So my friend and high school classmate Carl Stern ran BCG, Boston Consulting Group, for 2 terms. He was elected by his partners. If you're elected by the people that you are leading, that sets up a very, very different dynamic. So certainly employee ownership, or electing the leaders, or for that matter, even collective representation as through unions, would all be ways of making the companies less leader-centric, so you would not then be as kind of out of luck if you got some kind of lunatic in there.
I'm embarrassed to say, you're going to have to help me out here, Jeff. Trying to think of the guy who was at Stanford who did all all those studies on excellence in terms of management and leadership.
Tom Peters?
Tom Peters, thank you. I think I'd remember his name after all these years, but did, you know, some real pioneer work in that area. Was at Stanford about 20 years ago, I think, probably emeritus and retired now. Tom, if you're listening, catch up. It'd be nice to see you or hear from you. But he used to say that it was much more valuable to have a leader or a manager who you felt was on your side, who took an attitude that was more employee-centric, as opposed to the idea that, you know, it's better to fear me than to love me. I want your fear, and I'm going to succeed more if I have your fear. You come down more on the Tom Peters side, I assume.
I come down, it depends. You know, Machiavelli said it's better to be feared than loved, and I think there is some truth in that if your objective is just to keep your job. If your objective is to try to get great work out of other people, then I'm much more on the Tom Peters side. But this goes to this paradox that the things that make companies and work groups successful are not necessarily what makes individual careers successful. And in order to do what you just said, Tom Peters told people to do, you have to put aside a lot of the element of self-interest. And that's asking a lot out of normal human beings.
Well, good to have you here. Let me know if you get that rage under control in moments of blind rage. Jeffrey Pfeffer, again, is professor of organizational behavior at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford and author of Leadership BS, Fixing Workplaces and Careers, One Truth at a Time. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening, and we're produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Suki Lewis. Engineer today is Jim Bennett, our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll, our interns, Latoya Tools and Jeremy Siegel. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.